Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 3:02 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is July 23rd, today being Friday. It's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought we'd kick off with this graphic from Morgan Stanley. It's the primary rationale that they're using to justify their claim that this cycle is going to be shorter than others, because by their measure, this rebound from the lows in 2020 has pretty much circumvented the recovery stage of the cycle, and it's gone from repair directly into expansion. So when people think about this type of cycle and the kind of environment that we're in, it's easy to get sidetracked. The reality is that one of the things that we get at the tail end of a big market contraction is extremely accommodative monetary policy. So instead of thinking about, is this expansion going to end imminently, we should perhaps instead think about what are the conditions that usually have to fall into place before a cycle ends. And well, the last thing that we generally get is that interest rates are rising and liquidity is being drained from the system, and we generally start to see an inverted yield curve. And an inverted yield curve can be a lead indicator for anything up to about 18 months ahead of a big contraction. So we're not there yet, and the expansion phase in the last big bull market lasted for about 4, maybe even 5 years. So to think that we're immediately going to have another crash, I think would be the buying opportunity that many people who did not buy in the middle of 2020, that they're hoping for a big pullback so that they can buy. And this seems to be extremely similar to the kind of market environment we had in 2009. By the time it rolled around to 2010, there were still legions of people who did not believe that we were in a new bull market and were hoping for another big decline so that they'd have an opportunity to buy at last year's valuations, and they never got it. And I think that that is pretty similar to the kind of environment that we have right now. So then I think as we think about the dire prognostications that are being made right now, amid the fear of the pandemic, the rising fear about the Delta variant, the fears about inflation, and whether it's going to get out of control, how long it's going to last, and how it's going to manifest itself, what that means for how we live our lives, all of these factors are influencing people's decisions right now. And yet, stock markets continue to push higher. So one thing that I think is interesting is that because this rebound we've had from what is effectively the shortest recession ever, then that's contributing to this different kind of environment we have on the yield curve. Because the yield curve spread has not got back up to that 250 to 300 basis point level. Historically, after an inversion, the worst of the selling pressure occurs after the spread cruises through the 50 basis point level. So we saw that in the 90s. We saw it again in the early 2000s. We saw it again in 2007 through 2008. It was after the inverted yield curve starts to push higher that we get the most of the selling pressure. On this occasion, it was just as the yield curve started to push back up again that we saw most of the selling pressure. By the time it peaked in May of this year, most of that had already dissipated and we were well on our way to recovery. So we're let's be honest about it, back at the end of May of this year, the vast majority of markets had recovered all of their their pandemic decline. So we're in a very different environment from a yield curve in, a yield curve spread perspective. So it does support the view that we have gone through a significant, or at least we've jump started this recovery. So we are now into the expansion phase of this stock market advance and the economic cycle overall. So from that perspective, it is probable that the cycle will be shorter because we have jumped so far already. One of the other major things that investors are starting to try and price in is, when will growth moderate? Well, growth can't keep up at the same pace as we've had over the last 15 months, because that was coming off of an extraordinarily depressed level. So it's reasonable to anticipate that growth will moderate, and that's going to be okay, because that's what you generally see in an expansion anyway. The most impressive growth periods happen directly after the biggest declines, because these are all relative comparisons. So if we then just zoom in on that yield curve spread, we're also in a rather different environment because the short end of the curve is close to zero. Now, this trend remains downwards, and it has an extraordinary correlation with the 10-year yield for the simple reason that we have short-term rates that are close to zero. So that also suggests that the 10-year yield and the ability, or its ability to continue to rally, is going to have an impact on the ability of growth shares to continue to do well because of the knock-on effect that would have on yields. And it would also have this, and it has an extraordinary bearing on the outlook for the yield curve spread. Now, one thing, when we have these yields at such low levels, it suggests that if, for example, the yield stays at 1.25, and then we look at the 3-month, well, the 3-month yield is currently sitting at around 4 basis points. Well, if we start seeing quarter point increases, you would only need 5 of them to get an inverted yield curve, or at least a completely flat yield curve. We've already seen that the 2-year yield has popped on the upside. But the other point is that it popped on the upside in June, and it's been coming back down again. So one thing that has been particularly relevant over the course of the last month has been the ebbing in expectations for interest rate hikes. I think investors have pretty much come to the conclusion that central banks can't raise interest rates. If the Federal Reserve were to raise interest rates by just 2%, we'd have a sharply inverted yield curve, and it would be a lead indicator for recession. And by that time, we would have had significant deterioration in asset prices in order to price in that eventuality. So they're going to be extraordinarily cautious, and all central banks are now in the same boat. So we are back in a situation where the entire German yield curve could move back into negative territory, because the ECB said in plain English this week that they're not going to rush to raise interest rates. And they are looking more at the inflation rate trending higher, and that they're going to be very reluctant to raise interest rates until they have clear evidence of inflation. So this represents a sea change in terms of the psychology of central banks, because when the ECB was formed, the only thing that anyone was worried about was inflation, and the framers of the currency were very conscious of the risk of taking on smaller, more volatile economies on the periphery of the Eurozone and incorporating them into the German mark. So there was the insistence that there would be an inflation mandate incorporated into the forming of the EU. They never anticipated that instead of worrying about inflation, they'd spend the majority of the time since the creation of the currency worrying about deflation. So we're at a situation where the two major central banks in the developed world are not going to be in a hurry to raise interest rates. Then we can think about, well, what's going on in terms of this outlook towards the pandemic. So when we think about the emerging markets, they did really very well in the pandemic because they instituted lockdowns quicker and they were able to contain the number of cases. So production in the emerging markets was able to stay reasonably steady, and that helped to supply the demand during lockdowns for the rest of the world. And that was particularly driven by China because they were able to quarantine large numbers of workers within their factory dormitories so that they basically cut them off from the outside world and they had a captive workforce. So that ensured that China could maintain industrial production during the lockdowns, and they were able to supply the rest of the world with single-use items. So that got the global economy through that period of the pandemic, and it was the Asian countries did best during that period, and we had a significant rebound, for example, in the Indonesian markets off the lows in March as investors started to look at those relative comparisons. But the challenge today is that the Delta variant, which arose in India, is spreading rather rapidly through Asia. So we can see, for example, that in Vietnam, some of the factories are having difficulty staying open because of restrictions on movement, and that has contributed to the Vietnamese index pulling back into the region of the trend mean. But at least the Vietnamese index is still in positive territory. When we think about the Filipino market, well, they also have rising number of cases, and the not only is the stock market pulling back below the trend mean, but that the currency is also weak, so it's pulling back even more. And we see a very similar set of conditions in much of the rest of the ASEAN region. So the SET index in Thailand has also broken downwards. We see a broad pattern overall of these Asian markets rolling over. So they are the epicenter of the risk from the coronavirus at present because they have fewer vaccinated people. And perhaps the biggest challenge is that the majority of people who have been vaccinated in the region have relied on the Sinovac inoculation, which has been proven to be considerably less effective versus the original strain of the virus, not to mind the Delta variant. And the comparison with the UK, where there is an equally large number of new cases being found, and yet there is a very low transmission rate between the number of new cases and deaths, well, that is about as much efficacy data as one might want for an argument to inoculate most of the population. And the countries that are furthest ahead in inoculating a large proportion of the population, whether that's the UK or the USA, well, they are in a comparatively better situation. And the reality is that The Freedom Day has been mucked up in the UK because of the rising number of cases and because of the NHS's efforts to try and institute social distancing. This kind of app-based approach should really be used to get people to get tested. And by getting tested and getting tested repeatedly, then people can go back to work, they can stay in work, they can go to school, and you simply isolate the people who have been infected. And that is what would normally be considered to be what you would do during an outbreak. You simply isolate the people who have been infected, or indeed the people that become symptomatic. So I think it's inevitable that the UK will adopt that form of vaccination and isolation and quarantining, rather than simply telling legions of people to isolate themselves because they've been infected, with no knowledge whether they have in fact been infected or not. And exposure does not equate to to being infected. But the reality is that all of these considerations are being interpreted, and I think correctly, as a clear rationale for thinking that central banks are not going to raise rates or abate or to taper their enthusiasm for buying bonds. And I think that is the primary reason why we've had a substantial move higher in the S&P 500. I think it is also really instructive to look at the sectors that have been performing, because Moderna is the leader in mRNA. Then we have Facebook, Alphabet, Etsy, and Twitter among the top 10 or 11 best performing companies. And then Pulte Group is a home builder. And then on the other side, we have Intel pulling back rather aggressively. Now, that is despite the fact that they should be benefiting from selling chips, except that they can't keep up with demand. This, I think, one thing that we can certainly think about is it trending or ranging? And it's very certainly ranging. And it's ranging in a volatile manner, and the volatility is actually increasing. So this is not the kind of chart pattern that becomes immediately attractive. Well, when we then think about the kinds of companies that are doing well, McDonald's broke on the upside in here today, and that was a clear, dynamic move, bouncing from the region of the trend mean this week. When we think about Facebook, then it has also begun to really power ahead in here. Google's price is starting to accelerate, and it was up another nearly $100 in here today. And this remains an extremely orderly pace of the advance, where we see this staircase step sequence uptrend, and this is another step higher. So it really would need to sustain a move below about the 2440 area to even begin to question that this isn't still a consistent trend. And as long as that staircase step sequence trend remains in place, we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. So this clear conclusion that investors have reached, that the focus of attention now is on Asia, and that the problems that are occurring in Asia with how it has this challenge from the pandemic is going to ensure that liquidity remains abundant everywhere else. And that supports the view that we are moving into a more accelerated pace of advance, and there is clearly the potential that we're going to see accelerations, and that eventually we're going to have a bubble. And when we start to think about what would in fact start to initiate interest rate hikes, Well, it could be bubbly activity. It could be central banks worried about irrational exuberance. And we can think then that that irrational exuberance speech was made years before the peak, but that they started raising rates aggressively in 1999, and that eventually choked off demand. So we are at an interesting juncture here. We're also seeing that the number of IPOs is increasing really quite quickly, and these IPOs continue to do reasonably well, and the IPO index bounced from the region of the trend mean today. And then, of course, we also have the SPACs. Now, the SPACs have not done as well, but they also represent a steady flow of new companies coming into the market and a steady flow of new liquidity also coming into the market. So the transmission mechanism for liquidity from central banks pouring through into the stock market is still very much intact. And as we think about how is this all going to play out, well, one thing that we know for certain is that India also had a problem with the Delta variant, and the number of cases spiked higher, and then they spiked lower. And Indonesia's cases look like they have rolled over. So even though there are challenges outstanding, it looks increasingly likely that the Asian markets are less likely to be affected by the pandemic in the next few quarters than they have been in the last few. And the Indian market continues to push on, and it was in additional new high territory, up in a reasonably dynamic manner here, and looks likely that it will push on to new high ground. Now, when we then translate that into where potential is, if that were the case, if the only thing that were worrying emerging market investors was the pandemic, well then, because case numbers are starting to roll over in Indonesia, that should represent a bottom, and we don't have evidence yet that of a, like a clear upper dynamic to suggest that the Indonesian market has in fact bottomed. So it suggests that there's something else that investors are worried about, and we really don't have to look all that far for what that might be. Because high yield spreads in China have broken out and they are now trending higher. And that is primarily driven by Evergrande, China Evergrande, which is the largest issuer of corporate debt in the emerging market basket. And the underperformance of Chinese debt is translating into some contagion for the wider emerging market basket. So Evergrande has got a lot of debt outstanding, and this is a significant acceleration lower that we've seen over the course of the last couple of months. So it's unwound all of the advance from 2017. And the big question is, how many friends does the management team have? Are they going to be able to scramble together and to get the usual suspects to pony up money to rescue the company from the latest crisis? China has been allowing defaults to occur for the last few years, and the size and number of defaults has been increasing on a yearly basis. And this is just the latest in an increasingly long list of companies which are running into trouble. So now the question is, and I think it's really a challenge, and it's indicative of what capitalism with Chinese characteristics really means. And it's simple enough that if you lose, it's your problem, and if you win, then it's also your problem. So when we think about China Evergrande, well, the time that they did best was before Xi took power. And now the question for investors is how well connected are they? Are they sufficiently well connected with the new regime that they will get the support they need to keep the operation underway? It certainly accelerated lower, so the first key clear upward dynamic could well represent a low, but it's obviously a risk, and it is a risk for the wider market. If we are thinking about where risks are outstanding, well, then the potential for significantly higher borrowing costs right across the Asian region, that is a potential challenge. That's something that we need to monitor as stock markets continue to roll over in Asia and yet hit new highs in Europe and in North America. Then we can also look at what's happening in terms of New Oriental, because it was viewed as one of the really impressive growth stories in China. And in the space of the last 3 months, it has fallen from 20 to less than 3. So there is the clear scope that the profit potential for the company is going to evaporate and that they will be forced to cut their prices and they will potentially have to become a non-profit, which basically means that the company, which has been in existence really for years and was one of the most successful IPOs for our listings of a Chinese company in the US, is over. And companies are now finding themselves the subject of opprobrium from the Communist Party. So, one of the things that we're definitely seeing in China, and it's something that Mrs. Tracy was talking to me about a couple of months ago, is that there is a silent rebellion going on where you have young people that are simply not engaging with the economy, where they're not out buying, they're not going to restaurants, but most particularly, they're not getting married. And if they do get married, they're engaging in small ceremonies, and then they're refusing to have children because they don't want to bring people into this world, and they don't want their potential offspring to endure the same kinds of world or experience of the world that they've had to put up with. So when the Chinese Communist Party says, oh, the one-child policy is over and now you can have three children, a lot of people complained and said, well, how on earth could anybody afford to have three children? It's already too expensive to have one. Well, taking the profit potential away from a tutoring company isn't going to ensure that there are more tutors. And it's not going to raise the number of places at the key universities. It's not going to build new universities or educate sufficiently large numbers of people so that they can teach in those universities. It's simply a crowd-pleasing measure. So, this kind of knee-jerk reaction is really detrimental to investor confidence because the most important pillars of the standards of governance are respect for minority shareholder interests. Then you need to have an independent judiciary so that when your minority shareholder interests are infringed, you have a recourse to an independent court and you can complain to an independent press when your rights are infringed. And in China, you have none of that. All you have is the hope that you have got a sufficiently close relationship with the people in power so that your business won't be targeted for a culling. And that is something that is going to eventually have an impact on the stock market. So the CSI 300 is not rebounding. It has not broken down, and it wouldn't look good if the stock market were to break down in a big way. But it doesn't look like it's something that is going to be the clear big growth driver for the stock market, or for the wider market over the course of the next few years. When we think about the small cap sector and the growth drivers, well, investors in these companies have to ask the question, if the high growth company they're invested in becomes successful, well, how successful is too successful? That is the primary question. So that limits growth. And if you're an investor in growth and there's a limiting factor on the potential for growth, well, then you have to start looking at valuations, and you have to start thinking about cash flows, and you have to be starting thinking about time horizons, and you have to be looking at when you can exit. And that's exactly what happened with the Didi IPO. Companies like Tencent, which was itself almost more, I think nearly 50% owned by, 46% owned by Naspers, plus a handful of additional foreigners. And then you have Didi, which was primarily, or its biggest shareholder was SoftBank. They weren't going to hang around and wait for the company to get doxed. So they insisted on the IPO. And there is the likelihood that the company is going to have a record fine imposed for disobeying orders from the Chinese regulator. And that makes sense. They were told not to IPO. They did it anyway. And that gave an opportunity to some of the original holders to exit. And they don't care what happens to the share after this. And I don't think the Communist Party does either. What they are particularly focused on right now is the development of batteries and the development of autonomous vehicles. So it's these kinds of companies are getting support, and these represent national priorities. 10 years ago, the national priority was to create a consumer economy, and they've succeeded in doing that. Today, the national priority is to become the world leader in the manufacturing of batteries, and they're well on the way to achieving that goal. The creation of the national security strategy and basically the warehousing of data, and particularly as it relates to driving and autonomy, that is primarily aimed at developing an autonomous driving system, primarily before Tesla does. And Tesla continues to roll out versions of its self-driving technology, but it's still away from, in fact, achieving its goals. And the share price continues to pause here in the region of the trend mean. I think it is relevant that companies like Tesla have not been firing, and that Netflix announced in here this week that its subscriber numbers in North America are falling. So the share pulled back rather sharply and steadied somewhat in here today, but it's been ranging for a year, and it really does need to hold this range if a benign attitude towards the upside potential is to be sustained. When we then think about companies that are eating Netflix's lunch, then Disney, for example, has it is the kind of company that is capable of going sideways for a long time, but then it broke out and it's now steadying in the region of the trend mean. As we think about the technology sector overall, I think the most important thing that we've seen recently is a wake-up call for the semiconductor sector that it is cyclical in nature. So we've had a significant rebound off the lows for example, Nvidia this week. And it might yet also go further and continue to push higher. And it could easily be dragged higher by the continued strong performance of other large companies. Because one of the most important things is that the S&P 500 has got a very significant weighting by extraordinarily large companies. And the and I'm going to simply pull this into a pull this into an Excel chart, and we'll very clearly see that a small number of companies, they generate or they represent the vast majority of the big weightings. And when you have Apple and Microsoft, Google with market caps in excess of 2 trillion, then we're talking about very significant weightings. And when those companies do well, then they drag the index higher. That makes it attractive to investors. As investors do well, then they pour more money in. It creates a momentum move. So this is, I think, one of the most important aspects of this bull market. It's that the overall result of investing in the stock in these ETFs is that you're investing in momentum. So when we think about investing in momentum, then that's something that becomes attractive, and it's the best performing strategy in the expansion and maturing phases of a bull market. So we've had plenty of that, and now we're still in this expansion because we've had such a short bear market overall. So there's the potential that the major indices are going to continue to push higher from here, and that we're going to see that a clear bubble evolves because there's no appetite for raising interest rates. Now, that of course begs the question, are we going to see a significant advance in terms of the, I guess, inflationary pressures overall? When we look at this market cap map, well, Alphabet is listed twice, and both of its listings have a market cap of 1.8 trillion. Both Apple and Microsoft are in excess of 2 trillion, and Amazon is about 1.84. So that's extraordinarily large, and Facebook has just become a trillion-dollar company. Then Tesla is at 619 billion, which is a shade less than Berkshire Hathaway. When we think about some of the valuations that we have on these companies, valuation doesn't really matter as long as interest rates don't rise. So we can think about Apple trading at a price to sales of 7x, and on an estimated PE, it's trading at 28. And Apple hasn't really had a breakthrough new product in a while, so they continue to invest and continue to do rather well in terms of selling widgets and their subscription model, but they haven't had breakthrough new products. So a lot of the advance has been because of liquidity. I think we have to prepare for the potential that we are in an inflationary environment, and that the early stages of an inflationary environment are really beneficial for equities. And it's not until inflation starts to become a problem, where we start to see pressures arising in the economy, that then that will necessitate central banks to act. That's when we start to really start to see the differentiation in the stock market, where investors really start to favor value because of the reliability of the cash flows. What we have today is this big debate about whether inflation will be transitory or not. I personally think that it's not going to be clean cut because there are going to be portions of the economy where inflation is transitory, and there are going to be portions of the economy where it is not. So, the kinds of things that have been inflating in price over the course of the last decade, nothing has occurred to question that they're not going to continue to rise in price. So, education costs, insurance costs, housing prices, those have all been increasing for the last decade, and there's the potential that they're going to continue to increase and may even accelerate higher. Something that we have had much less of in the last decade has been commodity price inflation, and we're likely to have more of it. Because, on the one hand, the virus and the pandemic and the response to it and the fear of it have damaged supply chains. So, that has certainly been a factor. Then, we also have more volatility in weather. Something that I've been thinking a lot about, and I need to try and find some data to support the theory. So I'm going to try and concentrate on finding some data to support this theory next week. But one thing that has really occurred to me is that since long-term capital management went bust, that was a time when investors thought that they had a system that could never lose money. And suddenly something occurred that was not in their data set, so it was outside of their experience, and that punctured that bubble of enthusiasm. So they never thought that a major debtor like Russia could default. Russia defaulted, and it completely cleaned out their coffers. So that was described at the time as a double sigma event. And basically, it's a once in a 100 year probability, which is statistically basically impossible. But these kinds of statistically impossible events have been increasing in frequency. So when one looks at a single data series and looks at spikes within it, then that might look like a once in a 100 year event for that series. But if we look at that headline, the once in a 100 year headline has been popping up with increasing frequency over the course of the last decade in particular. So the question that is at the back of my mind is, are we seeing more volatility in data series than we've seen in the past? So not simply that we'll occasionally get an outside the box kind of spike or event that influences a single data series, but that the frequency of these kinds of events spread across a large number of data series, does it increase the potential that we're going to have these kinds of events? Because we've had, in the last week, we've had the frost in Brazil and the big pop higher in the coffee price, and the price did come down somewhat in here today, so we might be getting some consolidation starting right now. We've had record temperatures in the West. We've had these extremely large floods in Germany. So these are all part of this increasing frequency of volatile events in weather systems. We're also seeing increasing frequency of these kinds of events in the financial markets. And the swift decline, the biggest decline in history, the shortest recession in history, the quickest spike in volatility, then the swiftest rebound in history in stock markets. The succession of these kinds of events, it's quite likely to have been, if we look back on the stock market, the bond markets, well, certainly the evolution of quantitative easing and the willingness of central banks to step in to stop the normal progression of capitalism, to weed out the weak players and to allow defaults, well, that has created more volatility. It's created this exaggeration in valuations. So it's, I think, very likely that the case or the Shiller index of valuations is going to go to a new all-time high. And I think that's been my consideration for a long time now, because one thing that I've thought was particularly relevant about the Shiller PE ratio is that it's not a timing index. So it's currently at 38 and three quarters. So it's exceeded the Black Friday event in 1929, and we're coming up on the peak value from 2000. Well, the price to sales ratio for the index is probably already at new all-time highs. But again, valuations are not a timing factor. It's about interest rates, and it's about and then we have to consider, well, what really would have to happen for interest rates to rise? It has to be inflation. And until we're out the other end of this pandemic on a global basis, well, central banks are just not going to raise rates. So that suggests that this anticipation and their willingness to talk about tapering is just that, it's just talk. And that eventually, what we're going to have to see is that this change in the culture of central banks, where they're not going to jump at the first sight of inflation. That's something that is very different from what we've had before. So they're just going to wait. They're going to wait until psychology changes. And that means that we're going to see people proactively buying because they're worried about prices rising in future. And it's going to factor into large portions of the economy. I was on a conference call earlier this week, and one of the people on the call, who was basically the minutes taker, he just chimed in and said, "Well, I don't want to pay $30 for a burger." But the shortage of workers in places like Las Vegas and the rising costs of food and rent, well, they're pushing up the costs of just casual dining. And I certainly know that Subway has been increasing their costs, McDonald's has been increasing their costs, and it's inevitable that wage demand growth will pick up. But we also have these challenges out in the horizon. We know that there's about 15% of the population haven't been paying their rent in the USA, and that moratorium on evictions is going to expire in some places at the end of this month and in others sometime in September. So that's going to be a limiting factor on inflation. It's something that could have a significant knock-on effect to the health of the expansion. And against that background, it is virtually inconceivable that central banks are going to raise rates. So then we can think about how do bubbles form? Well, bubbles form because central banks make mistakes. And It's not like they really could have done anything different during the pandemic, because the mistake was to go into lockdown in the first place. But that mistake has been made. Now we're dealing with the aftermath of it. And the aftermath of it means that they simply cannot jeopardize the integrity of the recovery. So we're going to have low interest rates for much longer than they are strictly required. We're going to have valuations that get to extraordinary levels. And then we are also going to have a situation where inflation will eventually pick up, and it will be unquestionably at or it will be an unquestionable fact that inflation is picking up. And it's not really until they start to raise rates, or even at this stage, because valuations are so high and the sensitivity of the market to interest rates, in other words, the convexity of the market is so high that even a tapering of assistance will have a knock-on effect for asset prices. So as long as liquidity remains abundant, we can see prices accelerate higher. And I think it is likely that we're going to continue to see prices accelerate higher, because with high yield bond spreads rising in Asia and the threat of the moratorium on evictions expiring in the USA, there are sufficiently large numbers of events which can cause stress for central bankers. And in the meantime, that also is supporting the commodity-led bull market. So copper prices were higher in here today. This looks like support now in the region of the trend mean and potential for prices to continue higher from here. And copper is a secular bull market candidate, and copper miners are right in the region of the trend mean. Gold is a steady asset that should continue to do well as the inflationary bias in the economy continues to pick up. We have evidence over the la 4 of the last 5 days of buying coming in towards the end of the day. So if we simply just look at the intraday charts, we can see spikes lower all around 12 o'clock. And then the price starts moving higher in US time. So it's looking increasingly likely that buying is going on. I think the linchpin for this market is going to be ETF buying. And by the time gold eventually peaks in what is a secular bull market, I think that ETF holdings of gold will be the largest in the world, and they will have exceeded all state-owned gold holdings. We had a significant contraction in ETF holdings from the peak back in the third quarter of last year, and now we're seeing the price stabilizing in a mirror image of the higher reaction low that's being put in for the gold price. Gold miners have pulled almost all the way back down to test the low from March of this year. This looks like a first step above the base. And we're still in the early stages of the bull market. In the base formation, people just do not believe that we're going to have a new bull market. When you get the breakout, well, then people think, well, it must be a short-term move. But as long as that breakout holds, that's all the evidence we need that there are investors willing to pay more than they had paid at any point between 2013 and 2020 to own gold shares. So that alone tells us that there are people that are willing to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. Now we can think about, well, what is it that would encourage people to buy gold? Well, if gold prices can sustain the move above the trend mean once more and move on to a new recovery high. So we have the higher reaction low, we have the higher low and then another higher high, then that will certainly help to gird some support for the price. If it pushes on to new all-time highs, well, then I think we'll have a significant high beta move in gold shares. We're in a very different environment for the gold mining sector today than we were in the last bull market. And it's probably more appropriate to look at the Gold Bugs Index because there's more back history. But at the beginning of the bull market in 2000 and 2001, gold shares were really undervalued. And they rallied spectacularly for the next 4 or 5 years. And then they spent every penny they could lay their hands on increasing supply and trying to replace their reserves. And that contributed to a significant deterioration in their balance sheets and underperformance relative to the gold price. So, over the course of the bear market, they were forced to adopt all-in sustaining prices, which is a very conservative way of valuing a mining company. And today they've been so chastened by volatility that they are not engaging in new exploration. So if they're not spending money on drilling new holes, then they are increasing their dividends and they have got cash sitting on their balance sheets, probably for the first time in a decade. So they are still very cautious, and that's great news for investors because it means that there is the potential that one can, on the one hand, buy gold at a discount, which is the endless quandary for an investor. And the second is that one can get paid a dividend for owning gold. So we're at an interesting juncture because we know that central bankers will not raise rates until they have inflation. And they're willing to do whatever it takes to foment inflation. And there are potential deflationary forces outstanding, which means that they're just going to have to try harder to create an inflationary bias. There's been a lot of talk about the quantity of money that has been accumulated in the reverse repo program from the Federal Reserve. And the reality is that that basically $1 trillion has done a round trip because it was lodged by the government with the Fed, then it was sent out into the economy in the form of stimulus payments, deposited in banks, and the banks redeposited it with the Federal Reserve. So it's that $1 trillion of excess liquidity has been siphoned out of the market by the Fed, and they will simply put it back into the economy in the event that you do have deflationary forces, and that won't represent an additional new source of funding, like additional purchases of bonds via QE. It'll just simply take that trillion and push it back into the economy. So there's clear scope for additional new money to flow into the market. And when we think about the outlook for gold, it's not so much about bond yields, it's about negative real interest rates and the willingness of governments to devalue the currency in order to achieve their aims. And we have evidence of central banks everywhere willing to do that. And that means that gold has the potential to appreciate in most currencies. So we're still in a corrective phase, and we don't yet have conclusive evidence that the low is in, but certainly the factors are coalescing around the potential that we are at the bottom of this corrective phase and that the potential is we're going to see significant appreciation from here. And we're also in an environment where the large cap shares are doing well, and the kinds of companies that will prosper in a low interest rate environment and access to abundant liquidity will do well. And then, of course, we have the other side of the equation, the kinds of companies that are not favored in the current environment, and certainly the willingness of the Europeans to try and remake their economy and achieve some form of energy independence that is creating headwinds for the fossil fuel sector. That's the primary reason that I don't believe that oil prices are going to surge through the $100 area. But oil has been rebounding in here this week, and it is still trending higher. And regardless of what central bankers say, it is factoring through into the perception of inflation. So we have these points within the price series where they are still rising. We have food prices that are still trending higher. And the Futures Fund for Agriculture has continued to do well. So we're in this. I will just pull up that agriculture fund because I think it is a really important chart. And it has clearly broken its downtrend. So food price inflation, and then of course, if you have food price inflation, it's going to feed through into the potential for social unrest around the world. That's of course an additional reason why the number of 100-year events is also increasing. So this new inflationary environment, and we're really only at the beginning of it, then that is something that will create volatility. And when you add on to that the volatility we're seeing in the weather patterns, that's also inflationary. So we have a benign economic environment. We have a situation where central banks are clearly demonstrating a desire to create inflation, and that is the primary rationale for supporting the stock market, and it is the kind of thing that can last for longer than many people are willing to give the benefit of the doubt to, and that prices can go up a lot before interest rates become an eventual headwind. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.